Call the Senate Education Committee to order. Thank you for being here. Today is Thursday, March 21st, 2019. The time is 9:02 a.m. In attendance are Senator Birch, Senator Begich, and myself, Stevens. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're going to be hearing Senate Bill 30 relating to middle colleges. The intention today is to take up the CS, addressing some concerns that we've heard. Consider any remaining language changes to the bill, and either move out of committee today or tomorrow if necessary. We'll also take up Senate Bill 6, sponsored by Senator Begich, relating to pre-K programs and funding. Any questions, concerns before we start? Okay, thanks for being here. We have CS for Senate Bill 30 before us, version K of the bill. And can you get a motion to adopt that, Senator?
Yes. I move to adopt CS versus SB 30, version K, as a working document of the committee.
Thank you, Senator. I'll object for purposes of discussion and ask Mr. Lampkin to explain those changes in version K. Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. I want to confirm that we have before you a version K. That will be indicated in the top right corner of the document. Senate Bill 30, of course, is an effort to recognize the accomplishments of 47 other states in our country, establishing a collaborative between secondary and post-secondary schools, and the goal being to encourage students to finish their formal education. As was presented to you in, or many of you, at least in November from the Orwichi folks, some statistics from the U.S. Department of Education, in Alaska, of 100 freshmen that were looked at, 76 are finishing high school. Alaska ranks near the bottom in that category. Of that same 100 freshmen, only 33 are entering college. That's the bottom of the list. And of those 33, only 22 remain enrolled in college after their sophomore year. So the statistics are fairly poor for Alaska, and this bill would help address that because it's shown in other states this model type of program encourages students to finish high school and to at least launch, if not also finish, some manner of post-secondary education. Not necessarily college per se, but that would include vocational tech type training. So there's a lot of models out there, and one thing I've studied since we introduced this bill was those models around the country, and I've come to the conclusion that given Alaska's unique nature, that we can't approach this with a one-size-fits-all or a cookie-cutter type model. We need to find a program that's a good fit for Alaska. The bill before you is a hybrid. The traditional sense of middle college is a sense of a student physically going to a university campus. That's clearly not going to work for Alaska. Another program that's out there, the terms used, is the notion of what's called an early college high school. And so this bill now kind of crafts a hybrid between those two things, whereas the university can come to the student, to the high school campus, rather than the other way around. So this bill is not intended to micromanage. It's intended to be clear, set some goals, focus on outcomes, not the process, design a program that's flexible for various districts and responsive to the needs of those communities. Want to avoid creating barriers. And evaluation is key as well. So this is not intended to micromanage the program at all. It sort of sets up some basic parameters and allows or attempts to maximize the flexibility between the institutions, and that is to say the department, particularly school districts, and the University of Alaska. So with that, those are the introductory comments, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to carefully go through the CS as literally a sectional with you.
Yeah,
can you do that now? Okay. So section one of the bill... I'm going to go right into page two. First of all, we changed or added the word not just middle college program, but the Alaska Middle College Program. So got to give it its our own flair and our own distinction as a hybrid middle college type program. On page two.
And just let me welcome Senator Costello. Thank you for being here. I know you were otherwise engaged. Please continue, Tim.
On page two, lines 8 through 11, I found in the research of other states, there can often be a very, very long list of data points that are sought to help evaluate this program. Again, rather than micromanage or get into too much great detail in statute, We added those two references there as our common conversation pieces for this committee and legislature, and that is adding to the report that's given a rate of subsequent enrollment. So how many students that finish the dual credit program then go on to pursue beyond just 2 years of high school or college education? And then secondly, of course, to look at, of those students that participated in the program, how many of them in turn have to follow up with remedial type coursework in college.
So, Jim, if I could stop you just 1 minute. This requires the department, the board of the state school board, to make this report to us. And that information on enrollment and on remediation rates would be available through their working with the university on this. So I just want to make sure that they're the ones who would be responsible, not the university at this point.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The intent is to have the state board responsible for issuing the report, and it's intended and expected that they would work in collaboration with the university.
Thank you, Tim. Go ahead.
So the meat and potatoes of the bill starts in Section 2 there on lines of 13 down. This is that first section A is intended to reduce barriers. That's something that we found is important for the success of the program, to make it accessible to students, and that students shall earn, I want to point out the shall earn on line 16, both high school and college credit for the courses that they take. I found that one pitfall or one thing to be cautious of or aware of is the possibility, not saying that there's a motive for this, but the possibility of a student that completes the coursework in high school and gets credit for their high school diploma, but for whatever reasons, barriers or restrictions can be installed on the university side to make it more difficult for the students to get acknowledged or credit for those that coursework applied toward their college transcript. So that makes it clear that the credit earned is duly earned both in the high school level and at the college level. Likewise, on line 18 to 19, wanted to make it clear that the credits are transferable. Let's say, for example, a student, Bristol Bay, and is dual credit and graduates from college, goes to UAA. Those credits are applied on their transcript to UAA, but then they decide for whatever reason to move to Fairbanks, that those same course credits would follow with them on their transcript between various campuses. So it's just, again, trying to make very clear that the credits are fully transferable throughout the system.
Thank you, Jim. I have a question from Senator Bridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Lampkin. One question that comes to mind is, particularly as we start talking about university and that they will accept these credits, to what extent have we engaged the Board of Regents in this? Obviously, they have an oar in the water as it relates to, you know, kind of integrating the, you know, our you know, secondary curriculum and you know, how well students are qualified to move into the university system. But has there been any, I guess my question through the chair is, has there been any dialogue with the Board of Regents and you know, ultimately the university in this matter?
Through the chair, Senator Birch, I have not had any direct conversations with the members of the Board of Regents. Most of my work in communication has been through the administration, in particular with Dr. Paul Lair, who is their vice president for students, academics, and research. I believe he may be online, if not already. He's expected, yes, he is online at this time.
We've invited him to testify, so we'll be hearing from him at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But there also will be careful coordination between the district and the university, so it's not as if all credits will, basket weaving would not transfer. The university would require that it be a class that they, you know, that they want students to take, that they think is advantageous, and not just any class. Could you explain that a little more, Tim?
Mr. Chairman, so to clarify, I'm going to actually be coming upon that here later in the bill, but yes, it is intended that these be courses that are applicable to a high school diploma, math, reading, science, the core courses that help a student graduate from high school that can in turn be applied toward a GRE's general education requirements at the university level, not particularly aqua or aerobics, basketball, that sort of thing.
Thank you, Tim. Senator Hughes, thank you for being with us. Senator Costello, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Tim, thank you for
coming by my office and spending some time with myself and my staff to go over the committee substitute. You know, I'm very supportive of the efforts that the districts are doing right now to accommodate all students, including those who are ready for the challenge of taking classes at through a middle college program. And and we spoke, Tim, about what it looks like for districts that perhaps don't have a middle college program currently, and how this bill would take effect and what it would look like. And I know that the districts that are doing it are doing a great job and probably will continue. And so we have new districts that will be approaching this idea. And my question, Mr. Chair, was just simply if we could perhaps have some of the districts respond in terms of whether this would affect their budget, or how they foresee, you know, putting something in place when they don't have it now, and also if the internet access is adequate for some districts who might be doing this via online classes, because some of the schools are smaller and removed and remote from a college environment, and so we foresee that they'll be pursuing this through online courses, perhaps.
Thank you, Senator. We will be hearing from Dr. Lisa Parity, the Executive Director of the Council of School Administrators, and also Norm Wooten, the Executive Director of the School Board Association. We'll have a chance to hear from those folks. But that's a very important question, and I think you know that we can't solve the internet problems here today. I mean, that's an important issue that we need to work on, but there are some districts that simply will not have that bandwidth and the availability, and we just realize that all districts are not equal because of things like that. Tim, I'm sorry, Senator Hughes.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, good morning. I'm sorry I was in another meeting, and I'm going to have to slip out again, but I as you know, in my area, both in part of my district that's in the Anchorage area as well as the Mat-Su area, the students have the opportunity for the middle college. So I'm very pleased. It's a great opportunity. And we discussed it in an earlier meeting, but I just wanted to see what we could get on the record as far as, and it's related to Senator Costello's question, whether online courses would be considered equitable. So that a student in a rural area needing to, you know, not having a campus down the street, if they took an online course, would that be considered equitable with a student who would have the opportunity to attend in person a class on campus and that type of experience? Because I certainly don't want the state to be in a position where we're going to have to provide funding to bring students into campuses and house them. And so I'm curious whether that, if we have anything that can let us know that that's equitable, and if we can't get that solved here, you know, that perhaps that can be something the Finance Committee can be assured of. So, Tim, do you have any information? I know we chatted about it yesterday, too.
Through the Chair, Senator Hughes, that brings us to the next section of the bill on version K, B there, page 2, lines 20 to 23. The intent here is, again, not for this to be a one-size-fits-all. It's intended that the districts and the university enter into an agreement, a contract, an MOU, if you will, at the district level. Each district will identify what they can or can't do, and we're not talking necessarily that on the effective date of this bill that there be a statewide huge program amongst all of the districts. Some districts may look at it and they simply don't have any students that would be eligible, and so their agreement could be that they can't do it because they have no one to participate in the program. They may have a single gifted student or exceptional student that does qualify, and they might just offer, say, one English class. That could be their middle college program. It's just simply one class. For example, districts will have challenges or infrastructure difficulties with their internet. Those are all things that the bill is intended to compel the district and the university to collaborate on and address. As you know, there are other efforts out there currently to improve broadband and things of that nature that presumably over time this program and things such as broadband will improve and grow and provide better opportunities for all students. It's certainly not intended that, and the bill is carefully worded, to not put the state in a position to require students to fly in and out of to the campuses to attend a class once a week. I have an interest in reaching out to the Attorney General's office to confirm that on record. I have been assured by our legal department that the bill is crafted now such that there should not be a litigation trigger on the basis of equity.
That's a very important question, Senator Hughes. And today, at our extended sites, like in Sitka or Ketchikan, Kodiak, Kenai, many students take classes online. And if the class is not available but the teacher in Kenai, they take it online through the university. And so it's happening right now that we're doing it. I have to admit that it's not equitable. I mean, taking a class in front of a professor is a better form of education, I think, than taking it online. So equitability is an important issue. We can't solve that in this bill. And as Tim has indicated, we have no intention of making any provision that we have to fly students in to take these classes. Yes.
I think maybe for you and me it might not be equitable, but when I talk to young people who have experienced it, if it's not a static course, but if it's interactive and live, that they feel as if they're actually in the room and get to know the professor and their classmates. So I think the generation coming up, they might consider it equitable. In fact, I heard yesterday Commissioner of Education mentioned to me that there was a student here from another part of the state going to UAS, and the particular courses they needed, they ended up signing up. Everything was online, and they realized, oh, they weren't actually attending the campus, so they returned and saved some money on housing and went back home. So that kind of tells me that for the generation coming up, that if the online courses are constructed and you have a very engaging professor, that it perhaps could be equitable. And I just want to say that we heard the bill about the broadband funding, and you know, there's another bill, my bill, that's coming, I believe, next week or soon, I hope, that would set up a statewide virtual education system. And one of the things I am wondering, and I totally support this concept because I think we should give students access. A little concerned of some of the districts, they don't feel like they're able and ready, and the shell language, we'll hear if they still are concerned about that. But one of the things, another way, just to think outside the box, if we were to set up a virtual education system that incorporated the university courses that are suitable for middle college on this menu, it would, and the university partnered with DEED to get those courses available, it would really take the burden off of districts. So if we kept the shell language, then the district, it would already be set up, and they could just send the student to that menu where they could start picking classes. So it might be a solution for those districts who are concerned that they maybe aren't ready and are hesitant with that shell language. So I'll just throw that out there. Of course, there's steps to get there because we need other bills to pass in order for that to happen. But I think it would complement and tie in very nicely, dovetail very nicely with this middle college concept, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And I know you're right, and we have made enormous strides in technology so that it's a lot better than it used to be. I taught a class by telephone, and I can tell you it was a wretched experience. I didn't know if the students were even listening to me, you know. But, yeah, so we've come far from that, and many improvements have occurred. Okay, thank you. Tim, please continue.
Just if I could contribute to that comment, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hughes, I think when the time comes, Dr. Lehrer online will be pleased to speak about a portal that's coming online very soon that will complement what you're describing, and I would like to believe will complement the purpose of this bill.
Yes, Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that the way that this section's been redone, Mr. Lampkin presented it to me in my office as well. It addressed most of my concerns about the forced relationships between that might exist between school districts and the university, and the idea that you would be able to negotiate and enter into an agreement that could both look at expanded use or very limited use, I think really is a unique and careful crafting of an answer to that question. So I'm very comfortable with this section that Mr. Lampkin's been describing.
Thank you, Senator Megan. So, in effect, a district that wanted to do something to only one class, they could do that and wouldn't have to do a whole gamut of classes. Please go ahead, Tim.
Okay, moving. So, again, I'm going carefully through the bill. I'm still on page 2, now addressing subsection C, which is lines 24 to 28. This is regarding eligibility and access. One thing I've read and understand from other programs around the country is that it's important that it be opened up not just to 10th and 11th graders as in a classic middle college, but as an early college high school to provide for 9th and 10th graders as well. It was mentioned in the prior hearing that there could certainly be instances of gifted students that should be provided the opportunity to pursue college-level work while in high school, and that section would clearly make that available at the discretion or provided that the students are demonstrating their ability to do this satisfactorily to both the district and the university. So those are the decision makers that will go into detail as to who's eligible and who qualifies, who's ready to do the work. So then in section D at the bottom of page 2 and going into page 3 is an important subsection regarding awareness. I've found that a lot of times one pitfall is that students and parents simply don't know that this dual program exists, and so that would require the district beginning in eighth grade through high school annually when it's time to sign up for courses or thereabout to provide information, making it clear to students and parents what's available, the process to apply, the benefits of this program. And I want to draw your attention particularly to lines 10 through 12 to address current concerns make it clear that there are specific academics and social responsibilities for being in this program and consequences for failure. So we don't want to set students up for that failure and try to make it clear to everyone involved before they enroll as to the costs and the benefits. The next section, E, goes into the financing of the program. This does not put the onus on the student or the parents. That subsection in lines 14 through 20 speak to the agreement between the districts and the university for them to look at what they can do and how to go about paying for it. It's assumed that there will be some cost from the district and that there would be some allowances from the university in the form of tuition waivers, maybe electronic textbooks, that sort of thing. And again, didn't want to micromanage this, want to leave it up to the parties involved to sort it out.
Thank you, Tim.
Bottom of page 3, subsection F, speaks to quality of the program. One other key component of the programs I found was it's important that both the district and university agree that the program itself or the courses taught are of quality. That is to say, they agree on if a high school offers a course, the student completes that course, but then when they go to apply that credit towards the university, they say they might feel that, well, this we don't really like that curriculum. We don't believe that was delivered correctly. The instructor isn't adjunct, that sort of thing. So this would make it clear that they agree on the content, the curriculum, and the quality of instruction given at the high school level. That would be a component of their agreement. On page 4, subsection G there, lines 1 and 2, found that it's wise to put some kind of cap on this. Those are arbitrary numbers that I chose from my own experience, and I would ask Dr. Lair to chime in at some point here that 12 credits is a full-time load. A freshman, sophomore, that's a healthy load of coursework to do in a given semester. It might be fine for a sophomore, senior, but in any event, wanted to not overburden a student with more than 12 credits in a given semester. And also, the conversation to date has been largely around the notion of a student walking out of high school with a diploma as well as possibly an associate's degree from the university, and that equates to 60 credits.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. And And I appreciate it. I actually would prefer that there be no cap in here, but I wouldn't hold up the bill for that reason, because occasionally there would be a student that could handle more. I know when I was in school, I was, you know, taking 18, 21, 24 credits at times, and there's some students that could handle more than 12. And in some cases, it's actually cheaper for the district to have them go through the Biddle College. I know we have that in the Mat-Su area. So if a student wanted to get more than 60 credits, it would actually be a savings to the school district. And the university, of course, is getting compensated by the district for that. So I would prefer there not be a cap for those go-getter students. Of course, it would be nice for the family not to have to pay for that tuition. But if it's actually cheaper than the K-12 regular program, I would suggest we might consider removing Section G.
Thank you, Senator. Good point. We'll talk with Paul Layer from the university and have him reference this issue, maybe get more information from him on that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could also offer a comment that to suggest that there's nothing precluding a student from taking more than 12 credits. It would just put the cap on this program. A student could still go to and sign up at the university for that 15th or 18th credit, but that would be on them. Also wanted to try to avoid, as researched in other models, that avoid possible abuse of the system, if that's the right word to use there, whereas the concept of maybe a student lingering in high school just simply to take advantage of free or cheap college tuition opportunities. And so, again, nothing stops a student or their parents to enroll a student in more than 12 credits a semester or to realize more than 60 credits through the program. But after they hit that cap, then the burden, financial burden, at least, would be on them to keep going.
And a follow-up to that. That is a good point, the student lingering. You wouldn't want that. I do see that. If a student were to pay for the course, they went beyond 60 and the family started paying for that, could those courses still apply for high school credit?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I can imagine that that once they get to that point, they would have perhaps two high school diplomas. So that would be a super student, perhaps. It's difficult to answer that question. It would be a very unusual situation, I think. But.
Yeah, and maybe Dee could tell us how that would work.
Right. Thank you. Lingering in high school, that's quite a concept, isn't it?
Senator Baggage. Thank you. I had the same question for Tim that you had. Yesterday, we have a student in Anchorage who's graduating with her BA and her high school diploma, and the lingering thing convinced me, by the way. So I was convinced by that, and this is a super student. She's graduating this year. But the thing that came to my mind about that I think may be helpful in this discussion is that both that what you don't want to do is exhaust. You know, you don't want to actually place students in some competitive kind of situation where they feel they have to get all those credits in to make a grade. You don't want lingering students, and I think that this bill addresses that. There was a third point I was going to make. I'm certain it was profound, but I cannot recall it right now. It was related to the very question you just brought up, Senator Hughes, and I just can't remember what I was going to say about it. But
thank you. We'll give you time to think about it. Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping just to get on the record a response to a question that I had posed in my meeting with your staff earlier about how these types of courses will appear on the transcript of the student.
That's a question through the chair, Senator Costello, a question for the districts. I suspect that every district has their own mechanics for publishing and compiling transcript information. There was an example given by your staffer of his transcript that I requested we could take a look at, but on short notice, I didn't get a chance to see it.
Interesting question, how that would work. Senator Baggage, do you have a comment on that?
I actually do remember my thing. It's tied to this question. Thank you. It's that goes back to your earlier section. The student who's enrolled in the program, back on page 2, section 2, that's the agreement. So, in other words, how credits would be, you know, determined, those kinds of things would be developed within the agreements between each school district and the university. And I think that's really the rub to the bill, and that's what makes the bill work. And that goes back to Senator Hughes's point as well, that they'll make the agreement and determine how those credits are going to be, you know, marked or how those credits are going to be reported. So that could a student get college, take a college course and get high school credit as well beyond the 60, that would be part of the agreement, I would assume, between a district and the university and handle the local level. So that's the way I read it, and that's what I meant to say earlier.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Tim.
Okay, so moving on page 4, lines 3 through 11 are no change to the original bill that holds harmless school districts funding and for purposes of identifying student enrollments in their ADM. It also provides that the parties, the university and the districts, can share transcript information to make decisions about what credits have actually been earned and so forth. And then finally, in section 3, lines 13 through 25, syncs up the University of Alaska statutes with this program, making it clear that university and districts will hold hands, come about an agreement to fulfill the purposes of this program, and to make clear, too, that the university will be evaluating the instructors and the coursework and so forth. And then in conclusion, then the Section 4 provides for an effective date of July 1st, 2020, to give time for everyone to ramp this up.
Thank you, Tim. I just want to express my appreciation for Tim. He's done a lot of work on this, talked with a lot of agencies, and found out what programs are going on and what models are working in other states. And I really appreciate his willingness to get so deep into this. And great job, Tim. Thank you. Further questions? We'll go to some invited testimony then, I believe. Unless anything else, Tim, you have?
That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have, I believe we have Dr. Paul Layer. We do online with us. Dr. Layer is the Vice President of Academics. Dr. Layer, thanks for being with us.
Great. Thank you for having me. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, very clearly. Thanks.
Hello?
Yes, we hear you clearly. Please go ahead.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. I'm mostly available to answer some questions, but I would want to address some of the things that came up in some of the questions to Mr. Lampkin. One of the things is that the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska have in their policy a policy on dual enrollment, and it's policy 10.05.015, and it says dual enrollment, which is the term we use for this dual credit that is in the bill. Refers to enrollment at the university by a student who is simultaneously enrolled in K-12 or homeschool, for which a student may receive credit at both the K-12 and post-secondary levels. The university encourages dual enrollment. No additional restrictions on dual enrollment beyond those applicable to all students, or to avoid violations of law or ensure informed consent by the parent or legal guardian, shall be allowed. So we, as the university and as the Board of Regents, encourage this kind of collaboration. So to the question about the board, and we also have regulation regarding obviously minors being involved in our classes as well. So there is Regents policy and regulation for that. With a question about being equitable, clearly in areas such as where a university center or university is nearby to a school district, the options for students are going to be wider. Students can take a wider breadth of courses if they have access to a UAA campus, for example, as opposed to being in a place where there isn't a university or a university learning center or something like that. However, for the courses that are available online, for example, if we're thinking about math or English or writing, the student learning outcomes or the objectives for those courses are the same across the system. So a student taking a class, a writing 111 class, which is Introduction to Writing, at a school district online would have the same learning objectives as a student taking it face-to-face in a campus. And to address Senator Stevens' comment, you know, students, a lot of students today prefer the online option to the face-to-face. They find it a better learning environment, and so it's a kind of a mix of students at this time. We are developing, we have developed a portal, was mentioned by Mr. Lampkin, which is sort of going to be, which is going to be a one-stop shop for students coming to the university to understand what options are available, both in a face-to-face option and online. And so this would be available for students and parents to be able to see what might be available with working with their district. And so those are some of the points that were made. And again, from our standpoint, a student would be taking a university class. And so it would transfer, it would transcript into the university as writing 111, as math 151, whatever our course is if, for algebra, for example. And, you know, we have some great programs now. Our middle college programs that we have established have worked very well and have been great partnerships for us. And we appreciate the work that we've done with those districts. And, you know, I think offering some options for parents and students throughout the state is something that we'd like to see. And, you know, we are working on other options with the with those districts right now. And so and we appreciate the work that the committee is put in on this bill. And I thank you for the opportunity to address a few comments and some of your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lehrer. We have questions from Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Lehrer, for your testimony and perspective on this proposal. Just out of curiosity, how are the it references on page 3 that and I assume this is already in practice, but costs associated with the program will be shared between the participating school district and the University of Alaska. So how does that work as one who paid bought my credits many years ago from the university? How do you allocate those costs, or how is that adjudicated between the university and the school district for a student that would be pursuing a program? Through the chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah. Through the chair. Yes, Senator Birch. Right now, with our agreements that we have with the Mat-Su district and with Anchorage School District, they are using some of their student allocation to pay the tuition at the University of Alaska rates. And so our rates are low enough currently that it makes it affordable for the districts to pay our tuition as well as provide the students with the fees and transportation costs for them to participate. So right now it's a it works for us because we are seeing these students as regular students. There's nothing, unusual about their funding pattern. Now, we may want to look at this as we're looking at other options for other districts. And so there is that clause E, which says they may not be required to pay tuition or full tuition or other costs associated with the program. That's an agreement that we would have to be making with the district, and we're developing some templates for that right now.
So, Rich, yes.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. That's helpful. I'm familiar with some campuses in other states where they permit auditing a class if there's space on a space available basis for seniors and so forth. Has the university ever entertained that, or is that practice, or is it something you're familiar with? Through the chair.
Through the chair, yes. The university provides a mechanism for students to audit classes. Again, it's a space available basis. They do not receive credit for that class, but students are allowed to audit.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. And thank you very much, Dr. Lehrer. I appreciate your being here and all of your assistance as we've moved through this bill. Do you have any comments before we move on the cap issue? 12 credits, 60 total. Any thoughts on that?
From the university perspective, we don't see the need to limit the student access to our courses. We've had students in our current middle college programs with MATSU and ASD who are taking 15 credits or some, in a couple of cases, again, exceptional students taking more, and are working towards their baccalaureate degrees, as was mentioned. I had not considered that from the district's perspective in terms of students exceeding their what they need to get a high school diploma, and that may be something to consider. But from a university perspective, if we can offer these opportunities for students, especially if we look at them coming in at the ninth or 10th grade, where they might be in courses for more than just simply the 2 years that they might be working towards a cap. So from our perspective, you know, we are available for students to take classes through the dual enrollment program. And so, you know, we have not, you know, if they're qualified to take a class from us, we welcome them.
Thank you, Dr. Larry. And just in conclusion here, I know there are many advantages for the university in this. I mean, students, more students coming to the university, and once students start, maybe more of a tendency to continue and actually get a four-year degree from the university. Do you see this as improving the problems we face with students having to take basic classes when they not being totally prepared, having to take remedial classes when they arrive at the university?
As you can see in the bill, one of the requirements is that the students to participate in this program need to be college ready. That is to say, they must not be in remedial courses, or they must meet our courses for college level math, college level writing, and so what this does is it in a sense puts some pressure on those students and parents and the schools to make sure that those students are college ready. And so clearly, if a student is in this program taking college algebra, taking college writing, they won't need remedial developmental education when they come to us as a full degree seeking student in a baccalaureate or higher program. So yes, I do see this as a way of making sure that more students are coming college ready. And that's what we've seen from our current program at MATSU, which has existed long enough that we're seeing students come to us now who have graduated from high school through this program.
Thank you, Dr. Larry. I appreciate your comments. We do not have, I think, Lisa Parody or Norm Wooten are not here in the room and not available. So let's go back to the committee and Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the current programs that exist. I know that some students who are not yet even in high school are taking online language classes offered by Middlebury. And I just wanted to get on the record that this would not affect any of those agreements that are already in existence with colleges that are even outside of Alaska.
No, I don't believe I can say
that. If I may, Chair Stevens?
Yes, please, Dr. Lair.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, you are correct. We would like the university to be the first stop for students, but we have had students taking classes within our university who are, as you say, in seventh or eighth grade. If they meet our standards and our qualities and we have parent permission, we welcome those students to come to the university. And I don't see this bill as precluding any existing agreements. Again, we would like to be the first stop that parents and districts think about when they think about college credit.
Yes, please, Senator Costello.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I know everyone here in the room is aware that the Anchorage School District has several language immersion programs, including Japanese, Spanish, Russian, and I think German. And I think that one of the challenges that students have when they are college bound is that they oftentimes want to take 4 years of language arts in the high school, and sometimes, for example, if they've gone to the Rilke-Schule, they might be. I talked to a constituent recently who is a freshman taking German 3, and so I think this has a lot of applicability to those language learners, because they can continue in their language and perhaps go even further than what we're currently able to provide in the high school setting. So I think this is really exciting for those students who want to continue with the same language that they've been learning in elementary school.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Let's move on to the fiscal note then. Are there, we have department here, any comments on, does this fiscal note affect, does this CS affect the fiscal note at all? If you flip to that fiscal note. Thank you. And for the record?
Hi, for the record, my name is Deb Riddle, and I work for the Department of Education Division Operations Manager and the CTE Director. There's no change to the fiscal note.
Good. Want to get that on the record? All right. Thank you very much. That was easy. Okay, so let's move on to public testimony then. We have Posey Boggs with us. Posey, do I have you right for this bill? Posey Boggs, are you with us?
Chair Stephen, she just walked out.
Okay, thank you. So, any further discussion?
Sure. Did I do that right? This is Posey. I'm sorry.
Oh, hi, Posey. Yes, didn't want to miss you. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. This is Posey Boggs, and for SB 30, I'm testifying just on my behalf. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, hear you, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. I fully support, and thank you, Senator Stevens, for bringing this bill forward. And I'm just wanting to share that I graduated high school 1 year early, way, way back in 1975, because I took college courses every summer. And had I had the internet and strong broadband and online classes, I could have graduated even earlier. It did take a lot of strong self-advocacy on my part and my father's part to insist that the high school accept these credits. And so I just wanted to tell you that I fully support the ability of high school students to take college classes and to make a smooth way for the high schools to accept the credits. I was told when I had enough credits to graduate early that they really didn't want to accept these for high school, because what did it matter? I was already married. And so anything we can do to not cause students such trouble is awesome. And I'm glad it's not 1975 anymore. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Posey. I appreciate your comments. I knew you were a student who would move ahead fast. I was a slacker in high school, I guess. Didn't even have that opportunity years and years ago to take college classes in high school. But this is an amazing opportunity students have today. And we have no further discussion, no further public testimony. I'll close the public hearing and return to the committee. Any further questions or comments? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on the analysis page of the fiscal note, so page 2, which I always find very helpful reading this section of the material. In the second paragraph, it says that in order to be eligible, a student must have completed 10th grade, and I just wanted to put on the record that it's my understanding that this current version of the bill does not limit this to 11th and 12th graders.
Yes, you're quite right. That is true. It doesn't limit it, and it would be available to all students and even earlier than high school. So.
Should we cross that off, or is that something just to put on the record?
We'll just have that on the record.
Okay,
that's fine, yeah. Thank you. Further comments? Okay, then we have a motion before us. I will remove my objection, and we have before us CS for Senate Bill 30, version K, and we'll take an at ease to sign the documents.
Do you want me to move it?
Yes, would you? Senator Burge.
Chairman, I move SB 30 version K from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Burge. We'll take a brief at ease. To committee meeting. Next up is Senate Bill 6 relating to pre-K programs and funding, sponsored by Senator Begich. Intention is to roll out this bill, get the conversation on the table, hear from stakeholders and the administration, entertain questions and discussion on the bill, take public hearing, and hold the bill for further review. Senator Begich, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having us here and for listening to this presentation on Senate Bill 6. My name is Tom Begich. I'm the state senator for District J in Anchorage. With me on my left is Jacob Garish, who's staff to Senator Kawasaki, who's co-sponsor of this bill and who sponsored similar legislation in the other body. I also have online my staff assistant, Dr. Sidney Linneman, who's in Anchorage right now, in case I need two or three lifelines. We also have some invited testimony, and I know the department is in the back, and they are here to talk through the fiscal notes, as well as any other questions you may have that are more directly related to the department. This bill has come before the in the prior legislature, a similar bill, identical bill, came before this body, but I'm going to go ahead and do the entire sponsor statement, if that's all right, and then turn it over to Mr. Garish to go through the sectional analysis. And then we'll be open for questions, or if you want to interrupt me at any time during either the sponsor statement or during the sectional, that'd be fine. Early education is imperative for our state. When examining Alaska's long-term economy, it's essential to consider how we both increase Alaskans' productivity as well as reduce potential drains on resulting from the unrealized potential of our citizens. I know we're all talking about those issues now. This bill is particularly important because of that. And early education in particular helps, we know, prepare kids for success in the future. Those markers for success develop early in life. I have spent the last 30 years or so working around the field of juvenile justice and delinquency prevention and education. And one of the things I've learned is how fast we've developed what science has described as the ability of understanding how the brain works and how it actually functions. And what's crucial are those early years. Those early years are the ones where we retain our neural connections, and those are the years that we must stimulate the brain, provide vocabulary, provide learning opportunities for kids. Those early years, in particular before we enter kindergarten, are critical, and we know from our own data and from data around the country that when you do provide a evidence-based early education experience improves the ability to not just function at the kindergarten level, but also in our both in our state and elsewhere. It improves lifetime outcomes as well as outcomes at the third grade level, eighth grade level, and other grades further on. How we're prepared has a dramatic impact on all aspects of life. There are studies, including the Perry Pre-K study and other studies, that show that for every dollar we invest in pre-K today, we could see as much as a $7 long-term government reduction, a reduction in government expenses for kids because they don't need remedial education, they don't become involved in the criminal justice system, and they don't become involved in our public assistance systems. High-quality early education is investment in the future. Universal early education that's voluntary and available to students before they enter kindergarten improves school readiness, reading levels, and long-term economic performance. I'm not going to talk so much about the national studies as look at some of our local data. For the last 10 years, Alaska has experimented with pre-kindergarten programs, providing evidence-based approaches, looking at qualifications for those who teach early education, in particular pre-kindergarten. If you look at the data, I handed a sheet out. Is that sheet in front of them? Checking with the staff. That sheet was last given to us last year, and it shows that in at least four of the districts here in the state where we've had a pre-kindergarten experience, we've seen some dramatic successes with pre-kindergarten. The Mat-Su School District Pre-Elementary Grantee Program, in particular, if you look at their special education Title I program. These are kids that are doing the pre-K, and you'll see the difference between them and the district average. These are the special education students are overperforming in letter sound fluency and at nearly equal to the district average in letter naming fluency. And if you look at their other pre-K programs, WMP, I don't know how to pronounce ENALC, I think that's how you do it, you'll see that they are also overperforming the district average in pre-K. Right below that is the LKSD numbers. That's the Lower Kuskokwim School District. You'll see that the pre-K versus the non-pre-K students, and these are, they're going to testify later, but they have pre-K in some of their schools and not in other schools. You'll see the difference in the performance by third grade in those. This, again, is the Alaskan example. On the next page, you'll see the same for Anchorage, and you'll see the same for the Nome School District, where, again, where those who didn't attend those who did attend pre-K in Nome in particular are performing well above those who did not attend. So in each of these cases, we're talking about by third or fourth grade, we're seeing achievement from those who actually have gone through the pre-kindergarten experience here with our limited grants. What this bill does is simply supply an opportunity for every district in the state to potentially access pre-kindergarten. It's not a mandatory pre-kindergarten, but it is a universal pre-kindergarten, meaning that it would be available at one point or another to every district in the state. Parents would always control their ability to choose whether to enroll their kid in pre-kindergarten or not. I would say that the reason this district does a cohort approach is to limit the impact over years and to ensure that the districts are provided the necessary support from the Department of Education to develop a high-quality pre-kindergarten program. We really thought about that. There have been a lot of bills in the past that have said, let's just simply do pre-kindergarten, we'll just do it and say we've got it. That's not sufficient. If you look around the country, where there are instances where pre-kindergarten has not shown success, those are where they received either no support from their Department of Education or whether the support was, or whether the pre-kindergarten program did not have specific parameters designed around evidence. So it's not good enough to just say the words pre-K. You have to actually demonstrate a working program, and I have faith that our department can do that. They have demonstrated that over the last decade, and I believe that they can do that through this bill for the rest of the state. This is a small investment. You know, we invest intelligently in oil and gas royalties. We have invested to build a permanent fund that is one of the largest potential elements for our future economy in the state. We should do the same kinds of investments for our children. Early education has the potential to create a generation of Alaskans who are truly prepared to take advantage of the opportunities of the 21st century. So I hope that you will not just consider this bill and work with me to help improve this bill, but that we'll see this bill move on to other committees and hopefully eventually to the floor of the Senate. So with that, I'll turn it over to, if there are no questions, I'll turn it over for sectional analysis to Mr. Garish.
Thank you. Senator Garish, any comments or thoughts at this point? Thank you. We'll have more later, I'm sure. And go on to Jacob for sectional.
Thank you, Chair Stevens and the rest of the committee. Again, my name is Jacob Garish, staff to Senator Kawasaki. Senate Bill 6 is, again, the Alaska Early Education Program legislation. Starting with Section 1, Section 1 establishes that elementary schools also include an early education program, whether operated within a public school or by an outside organization, such as Head Start. Moving on to Section 2, establishes that a 4 or 5-year-old who has not attended kindergarten is eligible to attend a public school early education program. Section 3 establishes the structure of the early education grant program. It creates a stair-step 3-year grant program to provide training and assist a school district in developing an early education program. The way it works is in year one, the lowest performing 20% of school districts, as established in 2018, it would be by the school and district accountability standards, will be eligible for a grant to establish a district-wide high-quality early education program. In year two, the next lowest performing 20% of school districts would be eligible for the 3-year grant program. And at the end of a 3-year grant cycle, the Department of Early Education, of Education and Early Development, will be responsible for determining if the district's early education program complies with state standards. The next year, the grants will be available to the next lowest 20% until all school districts are offered the opportunity to participate. Moving on to Section 4, it directs the department to supervise all early education programs and approve those early education programs created by the Early Education Grant Program. Section 5 defines an early education program as a pre-kindergarten school for students 3 to 5 years old if its primary function is educational. The three-year-old students are not actually included in the program this bill proposes, but are included in this section to ensure that they are not excluded from what is already existing, either state or federal programs.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, as Senator Begich again for the record, that's simply to ensure that we don't, I want to describe that was a point of confusion last year. We include that so that the definition doesn't cause us to exclude Head Start and other early education programs, parents as teachers, other programs that, might be receiving other types of federal funding resources. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, Jacob Garish here. Section 6 directs the board to adopt regulations regarding funding, as well as statewide and local goals for early education programs. Regulations shall ensure that early education programs have flexibility to be locally designated and culturally appropriate, so long as they meet early education standards. The early education programs under this legislation may either be full day for 6 hours or half day, at least 2 hours. That section also specifies that lead teachers must be accredited and they must have actual training in early education teaching. Section 7, it includes for funding purposes, an early education shall be counted in the school district's average daily membership as a half-day student once the early education program has been approved by the department. Section 8 adds early education to consideration for determining the number of elementary schools in the district. Section 9 ensures that early education students who currently receive state or federal funding for early education are not included in the average daily membership for purposes of funding. Section 10 directs early education program staff to be included and the organizations required to report evidence of child abuse. And finally, Section 11 repeals the early education grant program in 10 years once all school districts have had the opportunity to participate. And that concludes the
Thank you very much,
sectional.
Chair.
Yes.
So going back to the half-day student, is that average daily membership, is that exactly half of the ADM? Is that how that works?
Mr. Chairman, this is Senator Begich for the record. Yeah, that's correct. The department tried to come up with a number that would be a fair equitable determining that, and they came up with a half day, literally cutting the average, looked at the statewide average, cut it right in half, and came up with that number.
Very good. Little short people, so they only get half of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the standpoint, at least in looking at Anchorage, they've had seen a declining enrollment in their K-12 population in the Anchorage School District. Would this basically add to, or what sort of an impact would it have in Anchorage if you, reaching down to potentially three-year-old children, or early education program, would this actually add to the ASD enrollment in one capacity or another, and would there be, how many students would be involved, and how many associated teaching positions would be involved with that? I'm just trying to get a kind of sense of the magnitude of the impact.
Thank you, Senator Burstein, the chair. This is Senator Begich again. Anchorage is actually in a unique situation here because they do operate a form of pre-kindergarten today. What would likely happen, and I can't speak for the superintendent of Anchorage, but I would suspect what the superintendent of the district would do would be apply to Department of Education Early Development to be certified as an existing evidence-based pre-K program based on the fact that they already have one in existence. They could then potentially roll their pre-kindergarten population into their ADM. It would offset the declines to some degree that they're seeing there. Remember, it's half basically you're counting as half a student. The Anchorage number is probably in the neighborhood. I would say we have about 10,000 in the cohort of four-year-olds, 10,000 kids statewide, so that probably that's going to be around 4,000 of those kids. I'd suspect Mat-Su is a higher proportion, you know, proportionally to population, but I would guess that amount. They're already being served by pre-kindergarten to some degree, to a great degree in Anchorage, so I wouldn't think it would add a lot of teachers to that. But what it would do is offset some of the decline that will be reflected in the ADM, in the ADM count in Anchorage, and consequently the decline in funding that would come to Anchorage for the base student allocation. So in a way, it would sort of offset that decline. There's a fiscal note that's rather substantial with the bill over time. But when you consider that there is this statewide population decline that's occurring in the state, in a way, you may not see that actual fiscal impact. It might be the ideal time to do universal voluntary pre-K because of that. I would. I think that's sufficient. I think that lays out for you one of the advantages of the bill that could immediately support pre-kindergarten for those who have an evidence-based approach today. But it would also take resources to those districts that are, quite frankly, some of the lowest performing in the United States right now, which would be that first cohort.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator. We'll get into more detail on the fiscal note later.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
My lifeline in Anchorage has just told me it would be 847 are in Anchorage pre-K, and in Mat-Su right now there were 341, I think she said, 391. So that's just for four-year-olds.
Thank you. Could have a lifeline like this.
Dr. Linneman comes through again.
Thank you, Senator. For the comments, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question actually might be for the department, Senator Begich, but I was curious in terms of how this would look when we look at the foundation formula reporting. So, for example, as you know, in larger schools, students are counted as less than one person for the formula as a multiplier. It's that first column, as you know. And then in certain communities, one child is counted as up to four people, four students, and then that goes through the multiplier. So when we're looking at the impact of this legislation, I would be curious to know how the department, or perhaps you've had this discussion, how they would accommodate that chart for the purposes of understanding, because as I read the fiscal note, you've essentially taken the full state aid entitlement of $1.1 billion and divided it by the average daily membership total, mm-hmm. and then put that in, you know, and halved that number. So that number is $9,260, and then you would have that and apply that for every child who would be in the pre-K system. And then once they became a kindergartner, for example, in a remote rural community, they would bump up to four individuals. And then in my district, for example, at Sand Lake Elementary School, which is the largest elementary school in the state, they would now not be counted as even one. And so have you had that discussion with the department about how they see this impacting, or just, you know, communicating with the legislature and the public what this program would actually look like in terms of, you know, when we look across at how we invest in our schools?
Senator Costello, through the chair. I had discussions last year about some of those details, but I'm going to let them answer the more specific detail. But here's two things I would say, that nothing changes in terms of a child entering, you know, as a full-time ADM under the current law. It wouldn't change that at all. All it does is add the half-time, and it was strictly determined as a half-time ADM position for these. If there's any nuance, it's not reflected in the fiscal notes, and so I can tell you that we just did a straight number. In fact, nationally, when we've had these, this is based on the Oklahoma model, for example, this particular pre-kindergarten program. In Oklahoma, about 70% of kids take advantage, whoever's that was, about 70% of the kids that are eligible take advantage of the pre-kindergarten program. And in the highest state in the union that takes advantage of a universal voluntary pre-K program is 77% in the state of Florida. the highest state. District of Columbia has a slightly higher number. The reason I bring that up is the department calculated this fiscal note and these numbers based on 88.45% being a party to the pre-kindergarten program. I hope that that's true, and I hope that as nearly 90% of Alaskans take advantage of this pre-kindergarten program, I suspect the number is going to fall closer to the 70% mark. So I think even in that instance that the fiscal note might be overrepresenting the amount of money that it cost, but I'm comfortable with the fiscal note. That is not a criticism of it. That is me just simply saying I'm glad we're setting our target high. Again, that said, it was based strictly on a $4,630 average per student cost, which is one half of that 9,000 plus number. So, but they can answer that question, I think, more fully based on the question of whether it does or doesn't have an impact on an undercount or an overcount of a student. I don't believe it does, though.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Begich and Jacob. Appreciate the introduction of the bill, and we have several folks lined up to do invited testimony. Ready to go ahead with that?
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's begin with Angie Galanos, and Angie is with the Colorado Department of Education. Ms. Galanos.
Hi, thank you. Thank you to the chair and thank you to committee. My name is Angie Galanos, and I currently direct, and I just want to make sure you can hear me.
Oh, yes, I hear you clearly. Thanks. Go ahead.
Perfect. My name is Angie Galanos, and I currently direct the Colorado Department of Education preschool through third grade office. I oversee the Colorado State K-3 Literacy Initiative, as well as the Colorado Preschool and School Readiness Programs. However, I previously directed the Early Learning Program for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. DEED's approach when funding district-based preschool programs was to support and build capacity within district-based programs in order to assure coherent implementation of preschool supports. Districts who receive state grants for preschool, the $2 million grants, engaged in activities that coordinated resources, supported quality, locally designed options, and developed leadership understanding of learning in the early years. All of this led to high-quality district-led preschool initiatives. The Alaska Preschool Program was informed by implementation science and research indicating the most high-quality drivers for preschool outcomes. By supporting districts, DEED could assure that sustainable preschool programs are being implemented to serve children in high-quality programs. I was very happy when I was in Alaska to be engaged in discussions about this bill, Senator Begich's bill at the time, as I saw the approach taken in SB 6 as perhaps the best way to sustain preschool impacts. Preschool is not an inoculation, and 1 year of preschool alone cannot be expected to achieve great outcomes. However, when partnered within a district that supports quality implementation, the effects are great, and the Alaska Preschool Program saw these impacts directly reported by school districts. While the department could not report third grade outcomes at a child level, districts who participated in the program could identify and track child outcomes by using district assessments, those previously mentioned by Senator Begich, such as AIMSWeb, MAP, and finally third grade standardized assessments. District-based preschool works, and most importantly, has been demonstrated by districts implementing it to work well. SB 6 creates a structure that supports districts with quality implementation and the guidance needed to implement a coherent preschool system that plays a part in overall school achievement. In addition to meeting the access needs to quality preschool for four-year-old children, it requires local control over district preschool programs because Alaska district leaders and community members know the needs of their communities and sets to assure alignment in school-based systems. I'm specifically pleased to see the call for standards-based alignment setting an accountability measure within this bill that could demonstrate impacts. I also wanted to mention that children most at risk need effective and timely intervention supports. As an example, Colorado provides public preschool for at-risk children who meet eligibility criteria. One of Colorado's criteria metrics is free and reduced lunch. The free and reduced rate for Colorado is 24% of the student population, where Alaska's is 50%. Just again as an example in Colorado, Colorado legislated preschool slots 30 years ago for at-risk children by providing funding to school districts who then chose how to serve 3- and 4-year-old students within district boundaries. Colorado preschool slots can be used in school district classrooms, child care classrooms, and Head Start classrooms. And we've seen in Colorado the tie between preschool and third grade outcomes, and we specifically support that in our Colorado strategic plan. We are really excited in Colorado to announce in our most recent annual report data that demonstrates that children enrolled in Colorado preschool programs, or CPP as we called it, showed strong outcomes in later grades. And our data shows that kindergartners who participated in CPP for half and full day preschool were less likely to be identified with significant reading deficiencies than their peers who did not participate. Children funded through the Colorado preschool program were less likely to be retained during the K-3 experience than their peers. And finally, and this is really exciting data for Colorado, children funded through the Colorado preschool program were more likely to finish high school on time than their peers. We know that the range that Senator Begich reported on a dollar-by-dollar saved statistic, Senator Begich reported that $7 is saved, and this has been shown to be true through meta-analysis. The number range is actually $4 to $9, and the savings come into place because it's been shown that children who attend preschool are referred to special education less likely to need Tier 3 intervention, supports in reading and math, and less likely to be retained in third grade. And as I said, we've seen those outcomes in Colorado. We really support the structure. I support the structure that SB 6 creates because it supports quality implementation and supports guidance needed in a district to support coherent preschool systems that have the goals and outcomes for student achievement. I support you to urge. I urge you to support this bill, and I'm thrilled to see Alaska move forward and carry on with a quality commitment to early childhood.
Thank you, Angie. Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony this morning. How does it work? Do the dollars, in fact, follow the child to whatever program they're at, or how do you actually make that the payment or the service payment for the 3 to 5 year old, I guess the pre-K student, if you will, through the chair?
Thank you, Senator. Angie, can you answer that?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Birch, and we're talking about Colorado. Is that correct?
Correct.
So in Colorado, the legislature put in statute slot based. It's a little bit, it's different than the way that this current bill is proposed. So we legislate slots. So currently in Colorado, those slots are allocated to 24,000 children across the state. And those slots, at the discretion of the district, can be used for families to participate in district-identified preschool programs, which could take place in Head Start child care programs or, if the district has a preschool-based program, inside district-based programs.
Hello. Yes, please, Senator.
So may those dollars be expended in, private or, something that's outside the scope and function of the school district, but in some sort of a private entity? Through the chair?
In Colorado, through the chair, Senator Birch, in Colorado, those slots are given to the school district. So a school district would choose, based on an allocation of those slots, which programs within the district boundaries meet their criteria, and then that district would decide where that child would be placed. So in other words, if a child care program was working in partnership with the district and that child care program said, we would like to apply to the district for 3 slots, the district could determine whether or not that child care program met district criteria, met the indicators of quality, and then the district would make a decision as to whether or not they would place those slots in the child care program.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Birch. Senator Costello.
Thank you, and appreciate your testimony. My question has to do with the programs that you have in Colorado. We have before us a chart that shows several different pre-K programs, and it compares different results amongst the programs and then also their district average so that we can look at students and how they are more prepared when they're in a pre-K program. Do you have information like that that you could share with our committee?
From Colorado.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I believe not looking at what you're looking at for Alaska in front of me. I can speak to the impact of the Colorado preschool program, the 24,000 slots that we provide here. I don't have outcome data in Colorado for Head Start programs or child care programs or even individually funded district-based programs, such as those funded out of the Denver preschool program or the Jeffco district program, which are some of our largest districts in Anchorage. But our outcomes are based on those 24,000 slots that we provide across the state for the CPP program.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So if I understand you correctly, your state has you approve programs to be a part of this and essentially get some slots if the parents want those slots, but you don't have statistics, for example, on Head Start comparing, for example, a percentage of students proficient on literary assessments for kids who've gone through the Head Start program?
So through the chair, Senator Costello, much like Alaska, in Colorado, Head Start is a federally funded program, and in Colorado, the Colorado Department of Education doesn't provide any state funding to our Head Start programs. They operate as a separate federal program, and so therefore Colorado doesn't have the ability to track or follow student-level data as Head Start children move into our state system. We don't have a unique student identifier or a tracking system that would measure or follow like a four-year-old as they transition into the kindergarten system. We can track Head Start themselves as a federal program, can track growth outcomes during the year that a child is in Head Start, but they don't have any way to specifically measure whether or not that child is meeting an outcome at third grade because they attended Head Start. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Begich has a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I might be able to answer that question to some degree as well. Head Start, because it does have state-funded support, does report to the state. So that's why we have data on Head Start. It's sort of Ms. Galanos is getting at. The other thing that I wanted to just mention is that one of the elements of this bill that is different from Colorado is we really specifically say that there is a set number of standards, and you'll see that on, I believe it's page 4 or 5 of the bill. But those standards that are laid out really look at, really examine the locally based programs. They really emphasize building locally based programs. So the Department of Education in Alaska worked with MATSU, with LKSD, and with NOM, and with other entities to within a series of standards. You know, are we going to have certified pre-kindergarten teachers? Will we have certain types of curricula to develop locally based programs? And I think that's what's unique about both this bill and what we do in Alaska versus other states. We have such different cultural aspects, such different rural versus urban aspects here, that it actually allows a lot more flexibility than other states may.
Thank you, Senator. And thank you, Ms. Galanos. Appreciate your spending time with us. Thanks for what you're doing in Colorado. We'll move on then to April Blevins, who is calling in from Bethel, I believe. April, are you with us? April Blevins, Lower Cuscomb School District.
Is she there?
Hi, good morning. This is April Blevins. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you, April. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Lower Kuskokwim School District supports state funding policies that will ensure that Alaska provides access to high-quality early childhood education programs for all children to increase school readiness and to promote academic and lifelong success. Sufficient resources must be made available to provide for high-quality early childhood education free of charge and accessible to all. Programs cannot become stable without the certainty of funding. Children that are served in the LKSD early learning programs have demonstrated growth between fall and spring assessments in cognitive development, language, literacy skills, mathematics, fine and gross motors. Our data has shown significant long-term benefits, such as students who attended our state-funded preschool programs outperformed their peers on their third grade and fifth grade assessments versus those students who did not attend a preschool program. Quality preschool programs also close academic gaps. On the average, the LKSD four-year-old enters preschool with the receptive language of a two-and-a-half-year-old, according to our data. When they exit our preschool program and enter kindergarten, most have gained 1.5 years of language to help close that gap. We also provide other benefits to our programs that are not publicly acknowledged. Most of our programs employ local residents. If we have no preschool, that would create a domino effect. If children cannot attend preschool, then parents cannot maintain a job. Therefore, they must rely heavily on public assistance. This results in children going without proper nutrition, which school provides twice daily. All these factors affect the community economically, socially, and academically. Early interventions while attending our programs have led to fewer special ed referrals and services when entering kindergarten. Many delays such as developmental, language, growth, and fine and motors are lessened with interventions when the children receive those in our preschool program. Our preschool programs provide a safe, happy environment in which our children thrive. For young children who are experiencing trauma, they receive support services. Our programs also provide screenings for early detection, such as keeping immunizations up to date, dental and vision screenings, assisting parents with pursuing medical needs if that is necessary. We also provide support for families. Parents are more informed about services such as housing assistance, counseling services, possible employment opportunities, and so on. There are monthly parent events that offer parent education, literacy materials, socializing with other families, family values. Families value our early childhood education programs as advocates for their children and for their family. It's considered a safe, welcoming, and nurturing environment for everyone. Early childhood programs have the potential for prevention and cost effectiveness. In the past two decades, many studies have demonstrated the positive effects of participation in early intervention for school readiness, health status, academic achievement, reduced the need for grade retention, and special ed services. There is also evidence to support delinquency prevention and higher education attainment. Yet every year, our early childhood programs are on the list of budget cuts. If we are looking to save educational dollars, research has proven that your money is best spent in investing in our early childhood programs. For every dollar you spend, you get $7.16 in return, a great return on a great investment. It is time to do what's best for Alaska children and invest and commit to early childhood programs. We need stable, reliable, early educational system that our children and families can depend upon. It is time to get off the fence and invest in Alaska's future. Consistent action creates consistent results. All Alaskans, especially rural communities, need and deserve pre-K funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blevins. Appreciate your comments and your time with us. Senator Birch has a comment, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Blevins. What would you estimate is the percentage of participation in your community or that you're representing in the program? First off, and then secondly, what is the youngest age that a child can basically sign up or participate in the program? Through the chair.
Okay, through the chat, we expect, well, our data supports that we have a minimal of 80%. Mostly it's 91% attendance and a participation in our programs.
Great.
And then follow up, in the youngest age, we had some discussion about age 3, and then there's also at age 4, but do you have 3-year-olds in your program?
Yes, through the chair, we actually emphasize 4-year-olds first, so they get priority to enrollment if they're attending kindergarten. Due to the personnel and space issues, we prioritize the 4-year-olds, and if there's space, then we take our 3-year-olds. And then some of our village sites actually do serve 3-year-olds, but not the length of the day as a 4-year-old.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Again, thank you very much, Ms. Blevins. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Let's go to the Department, Education and Early Development, and I believe Elwin Blackwell and Deb Riddle will be speaking to us. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair,
I wanted to emphasize that this bill focuses on four-year-olds. The only reason three-year-olds are in the description is because there are existing Head Start programs and other programs that include them. We didn't want to define them out of early education. So this bill is strictly focused on four-year-olds and five-year-olds. Those are the only ones that are eligible under this program. I wanted to be clear about that.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Blackwell, pleased to have you with us. Your name for the record, please, and Deb.
Good morning. This is Elwin Blackwell with the Department of Education and Early Development.
Deb Riddle with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you. We're here to go over the fiscal notes, and I will go over the ones that are affecting the foundation program and the funding associated with the addition of the four-year-olds into the foundation funding purposes. You'll find that you have two fiscal notes here before you addressing the funding needs. I will take a look at the first one. This is dealing with the fund capitalization. And so this one is where the money is being recorded that would be needed to help to make the foundation program whole. And there were some earlier questions associated with this. And so what we have done in this fiscal note is we have taken a look at the total amount of state aid, the projected state aid, and divided it by the total number of ADM to come up with the average cost per ADM. And since this is funding the students at one half of that, in this case at average, we are now using that $4,630 number as an estimate of what the cost would be to carry forward to come up with a cost. Now, it is worth noting that every district is going to have a slightly different cost. This is just an average for being able to come up with a fiscal note. So in the end, to address some of the other questions ahead, if a district has a slightly higher, they would be getting more as these students go through the foundation formula. And so we used that, and we took these students, and since there's going to be five cohorts of students going through the program, in year 2023 is when the first cohort would end up transitioning into the foundation formula. And the fiscal note assumes that all of the programs that were developed in the first cohort would be approved at the end of the 3 years and transition in. So that assumption is carried through for each one of those five cohorts that come through. And so as you'll see, as it builds out, we end up with $3.4 million showing up in fiscal year 2023. That number then doubles to $6,801,000 in fiscal year 24, and doubles, and then that $3 million is added to the 25, and so on and so forth out to 2027, when the assumption is that all of these programs would be fully transitioned into the foundation formula, and all 5 years of the cohorts would then be transitioned in. So that's where we come up with the fund capitalization fiscal note. And the reason
Senator Begich has the call.
Yes.
Earlier I mentioned you've identified an 88.45% number for the percent of students that would be served under this, which is the multiplier you use. The assumption that you're making is that overall, all pre-K programs will end up serving around 90%, 88%, 88.5%. And just wondering where you came up with that number, and I don't have a problem with it. I'm glad for your enthusiasm.
Hi, so for the record, this is Deb Riddle through the chair. What we did is we looked at the number of students participating in preschool right now and tried to determine what we thought would be those students who were not participating that would come into these different programs. And so, on the fiscal note that has the really pretty colors, it shows that we anticipate that well, every year we have a cohort of students. It's usually about 10,000 per grade. And so we looked at how many students were already participating in preschool programs and then tried to determine what of those students that weren't participating we would hope to be, you know, based on the size of the districts that weren't participating. And then as we worked through, we looked at the first year. It says we anticipate 735, and then the next year that would double. And that's how we came up with the number of 88%.
And just to confirm, then at the very end, if you look at the color chart that's in our packets, the very far right, 17,015,250 is what it actually ends up annually being in terms of once you've rolled it into the ADM, and that's the base student allocation increase. Quite frankly, well below the kind of money we might be spending on Medicaid waivers and Medicaid work requirements and other things. I wanted to point out that is a fairly modest annual number being added to a $1.2 or $3 billion base student allocation number. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, that is the correct reading, that by fiscal year 2027, and all of these programs having transitioned in, the foundation program would see this increase of $17 million.
Senator Begich.
Which, Mr. Chairman, is about 1% or 2% of the total base student allocation number to have the opportunity to prepare all our kids. I just think that's an interesting number to put on the record.
Thank you. This is a question, Senator Costello.
Thank you. In terms of the foundation formula, could you share with the committee and the public what the multiplier is for one student who under the ADM is counted as one as opposed to four or less than one, but a student that starts out counted as one, what is the multiplier as you go down the formula for a special education student?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, you're referring to the school size adjustment, so that the way the foundation formula program works, we identify the students, the full-time equivalency students, and we generate an ADM, so that's based on a 20-day count. So if a student is there for the full 20 days, then is enrolled for the full 20 days, they are considered as one ADM. Then based on the size of the school, there is an adjustment made based on the size of the school within that community. And so it can, for a very small school, translate into about a 3.96, almost 4 ADM increase on a very small school. That is between 10 and 19.9 ADM. Each one of those students gets weighted. So if you have a school of about 10, you would get a weighting of about 4 ADM for that school size. It is true that the bigger the school gets, the weighting decreases to a point of about a school, if I remember right, it's somewhere over 1,000 students in a school, you kind of come down to a 1-to-1, 1 ADM equals 1 ADM in the school size adjustment. And so then those school size adjustments are added together, and then they go through the foundation formula and multiplied by other multipliers such as district cost factor, and then there is a multiplier for special education, and then there is a multiplier for career and technical education, and then from there we do have intensive services, where an intensive service student is identified out of that population. And then they are multiplied by 13. So each intensive needs student is multiplied by 13. That is now added to the product from the previous calculation. And then we also take a look at correspondent schools at the very end within that foundation formula. We multiply those by a 0.9 and add those back into our total now. And at that point, then we would take that adjusted average daily membership, and then would multiply it by the base student allocation and come up with our basic need number at that point.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So just to kind of explain where I was going in my logic, and I appreciate that explanation. I think the more the public knows how we arrive at our foundation formula and funding for schools, I think the better. So I really appreciate that. The assertion was made earlier that the more students who go through a pre-K program, the fewer special education students you have that are going through our schools. And so I know that our fiscal note process does not ever allow for any kind of long-term savings. I mean, these kinds of discussions are left up to us on our own, which is unfortunate, I think. So I was just trying to get at the special education multiplier. I thought it was 20%, but I could be way off on that. And so I just wanted to look at, you know, when you take this number and you send it down the foundation formula multiplier, what that special education multiplier is, so we could perhaps look at the contemplated investment that this bill does look at versus what we are spending for special education. And I thought it was just a multiplier of a percentage multiplier, just like you said intensive needs were also a multiplier.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, you're correct that the multiplier is 20%. So we would multiply it, the number, by 1.2.
Thank you.
And carry it
forward. Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. The foundation formula is extremely complex. And I always say I understand it after you folks have explained it, but a few days later, I'm really not sure because there's so many elements to it. But while we are dealing with it, and while you have explained it, are you reasonably comfortable with the foundation formula? I keep having people asking us to open it up again, and I would be reluctant to do that because it took us a long time, like 4 years to do it in the past. Are you reasonably happy with the foundation formula as it exists now? In that, is it being fair across the state?
Senator Stevens, the foundation formula as it currently stands does actually it provides funding to the school districts in a systematic way. I don't know if I have an opinion one way or another.
Well, if the department can answer that, who can? Maybe Senator Begich can answer it for us.
I'm going to try, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that. I'm going to say that the legislature answered that question quite emphatically with the Agenblick study, which was requested by budget and audit, I believe, in 2016, was released in 2016. And that study went in detail looking at every component of our foundation formula here. It described the multipliers. That's how I first learned about them. I didn't even fully understand the formula myself. In what was a multi-hour presentation before budget and audit, I think it was 5 or 6 hours, they walked through every element and concluded that it was one of the fairest and most equitable foundation formulas in the country. They had two exceptions, and we corrected one of those last year, and that was related to one of the school count numbers that was, I can't remember the exact details of it at this point, but there was a school count issue they said should be fixed, and we fixed it last year. So, I can only argue from the point of the experts we hired, and they seem to indicate as recently as 2016 that it was really one of the most equitable formula funding, one of the most equitable formulas in the country.
Thank you, Senator. That is my opinion, too, at this point. Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess two questions that have come up in working through foundation for me is Anchorage students that are weighted at less than one, and I just wonder if you could speak to that or like a 0.95 or something. I can't remember the specifics there, but if you could speak to that. And we've also heard from the school district in Anchorage that there's a kind of a built-in disincentive for consolidating schools, as it relates to the foundation formula and funding. So, in other words, according to the foundation formula, and I haven't
dialed this up, but if you have, two well under capacity grade schools, for instance, that there's a disincentive to consolidating them and closing one of those structures. So that, through the chair, that would be one question. And then maybe if you could speak to the fact that some students may be in the calculation may have a value, if you will, or a number less than one, through the chair.
Thank you, Senator. Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Birch. To deal with the school size, yes, there would be instances in Anchorage, particularly in the very large high schools, where a student may be weighted less than one once you got through the school size adjustment. So you might have 3,000 students in that school, and once you ran them through the school size adjustment, you might be, and these are just off the top of my head numbers, so they're not going to be accurate, you might have 2,600 ADM with 3,000 kids. So they would be weighted at less than that, the bigger the school gets. So that's the way the formula in the school size. Now, the school size adjustment table assumes that smaller schools cost you more money, so therefore there's a heavier weighting on those students. The idea is that as a school gets larger, it gets more efficient. You don't need to have as many resources to operate that school. So therefore, your weighting for those students for funding purposes decreases some. That's just the way the school size adjustment is kind of taking a look at it and running those. And the second part of your question, if you could.
I think you've touched on both of them through the chair. I'd heard that kind of anecdotally, and I guess that does kind of raises some questions. First of all, over where we have a whole lot more classroom capacity, if you will, building square feet of building in Anchorage than we did when we had fewer students quite a few years ago. And I guess I'm just trying to understand kind of the built-in the metrics that might drive that. As far as a significant cost component of education, through the chair.
Thank you, Senator. And not just Anchorage, but all around the state, districts are looking at consolidation of schools, and that would be a shame if there's a disincentive for a consolidation.
And through the chair, Senator Birch, the legislature did take up and pass a bill last year dealing with school consolidation. And trying to remove the disincentive, as it was put, for school consolidation. So the bill that was passed and signed into law provided a 5-year step down for districts that did consolidate schools. They would be they would see no decrease in the first couple of years, and then they would step down in years 3 through 5 to where they could absorb the lower the decrease in funding because they have fewer schools being running through the school size adjustment.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks so much. Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you, and I do remember that bill, and I was going to mention it. So essentially, what we were trying to do is, addressing this embedded economies of scale in the foundation formula, which provides a disincentive for schools to combine, and so. The bill that we passed has the foundation formula follow the student. So if a student starts from a smaller school and is counted as 1 or even up to 4, then they move to a school that now, because of its size, would automatically truncate that student's formula. The bill said for 5 years that foundation formula would follow the student. And so, we've looked as the legislature at school consolidation, and I know we have some, Prince of Wales Island is kind of the poster child for this issue. They have 3 districts on one island, and that's a district issue, not necessarily within the district. So we were hoping to, get rid of that disincentive that Senator Birch was talking about. I would argue a little different point about the foundation formula. I think that the fact that the legislature had to come in and make this remove that disincentive tells me that portion of our foundation formula is worth looking at.
I do think that as schools change and what they're trying to do and with the more career and technical education, that smaller schools can't necessarily provide for students, that it is the larger schools that are doing that. And so I would like to be on record as somebody who is open to the discussion and the opportunity to looking at the foundation formula, irregardless of how challenging or difficult that might be. I think that it's important that, that you know, for the public's sake, too, that we're all on board with how schools are funded, and it's not a mystery. And I really appreciate you walking through that description earlier, so I just wanted to mention that to my colleagues on the Senate Education Committee.
Well, thank you, Senator. A very good discussion, and clearly foundation formula is something we can readily spend some time on and try to understand it. Let's try to get back to the purpose at hand. And would you continue with the fiscal analysis?
Okay. There is a second fiscal note before you, and this is dealing with the foundation program. This is provided as kind of informational. You will find that there is no cost associated with this, and we do have a small note on the back in the analysis section of this explaining as to why that there is no fiscal impact on the foundation program, and that has to do with the way foundation is actually funded through the Public Education Fund, which was the first fiscal note I went through. And so the analysis is really all the same at that point.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Senator Baggage.
There are also other fiscal notes, and I think you're going to speak to those fiscal notes. And I just wanted to say I thought that because of the discussion of everything else, it must mean everyone supports the bill, and so we're ready to move on. So.
Yes.
So, for the record, this is Deb Riddle through the chair. We have one fiscal note for the early learning coordination that's proposing three positions and the associated costs with that, so $350,000. And then the second one we kind of talked about already a little bit was the fiscal note that talked about the number of students and how that was calculated, and that is the one for the pre-K.
Thank you, Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment on that those two separate types of fiscal notes. So really, if you could imagine if today we rolled all potential available students without any preparation, it would be approximately $17 million a year each year. That's, you know, so that would be, it's a perpetual amount. So what I really like about the separation and the way that the fiscal note is constructed is it shows you that we are using those first 5 years to develop the capacity so we don't create bad pre-K. That is the one thing that we must not do if all of this is going to mean anything. And so I really want to emphasize the importance of the grants program to prepare districts to do the right thing. This goes this addresses our turnover issues. It addresses high quality teachers and those kinds of things. So I really appreciate the way the department has put these together. We're talking about less than 2% a year of our current base student allocation to have potentially significant impact on our kids as they graduate many years after we're sitting, many years past the time we'll have been sitting at these tables.
Thank you, Senator. Further comments from the department on these fiscal notes or any other issues relating to the bill? Thank you very much. This has been a fascinating discussion, and clearly we're not going to have time to get into the public testimony. I want to thank everyone who has signed up for Senate Bill 6. We will reschedule this and have an opportunity to hear from the public. We will not be meeting on tomorrow. We don't need to do that, the Education Committee. So if there's nothing further to come before us, we're adjourned.